Good morning. Thank you very much to AMEC for inviting me to be here today. The resource sector makes up a significant contribution to the Australian economy. So just two statistics that we think about from a macroeconomic perspective is that it accounts for about 20% of business investment and almost 60% of Australia's exports. There are also very significant spillovers from activity in the mining sector to other parts of the economy. Data on inter-industry linkages tell us that activity in industries that support the mining industry increased significantly as a share of GDP between the beginning of the 2000s to the peak of the mining investment boom in 2012-13. As most people in this room will be aware, mining investment has actually declined since that peak. Our expectation, based on information that we collect as a part of our liaison program and other sources like ABS CapEx data, suggests that that mining investment is probably around a trough at this point. And we're expecting, when we produce our forecasts, that mining investment will gradually pick up over the next couple of years. Resource exports are also expected to make a significant contribution to growth. We do expect that as the current capacity is reached, that growth will plateau, or the level of resource exports will plateau at a very high level. I'm sure this story is very familiar to everybody in the room today. So what I thought I would focus a little bit more on is the longer term outlook for commodity demand, or our commodity exports. And because I'm a macroeconomist, I'm not a geologist or someone with mining engineering experience, I'm going to take the perspective of looking at some of the factors that are likely to drive global demand. And then I'm going to turn to the question of what can be done to take advantage of the opportunities and to manage the risks of this uncertain future. And in particular, I'm going to focus on the adaptability of the labour market. And I think you'll find that there's somewhat of a reflection of some of the comments we've just had from Dr. Guthrie. So quite clearly, the message is strong. And I think the session that we have after the morning break will make some of the comments that both I'm going to make and what Dr. Guthrie made are quite a lot more concrete about what is this education future, what is the change that we're looking for. Right. So one of the biggest factors affecting global demand for commodities is clearly population growth. If there's more people, they need more places to live, they need more food to eat, they demand more energy. The process of industrialisation and urbanisation also increased demand for commodities, although there tends to be a change in the composition of that demand over time as countries become wealthier. For example, diets tend to become more protein-based. Construction tends to become more steel-intensive as economies increase their GDP per capita. The increase in demand for commodities from these forces will be offset to some extent by technological change. So this is basically the process of technology allowing us to use commodity inputs more efficiently to generate a certain amount of output. As well as all these things, there are policy considerations. So an example of this is government's commitments to the Paris Agreement. And that's also going to affect the composition of commodity demand going forward. So to explore the longer term demand for commodities, I'm going to split them into three groups. I'm going to think about construction related commodities, treat gold separately, and then move on to energy related resources. Again, as everyone in this room will probably be aware, Australia's key construction commodity exports are iron ore and coking coal. These commodities are key inputs into steel production and accounted for more than 40% of Australia's total resource exports in 2018. This was an increase from about 20% of total resource exports in the early 2000s. China is currently the largest consumer of steel in the world by a considerable margin, and it's the destination for about 80% of Australia's iron ore exports and around one quarter of Australia's exports of coking coal. A Over the past 15 years or so, growth in Chinese demand for steel has been driven by a combination of population growth, industrialisation and urbanisation. However, when we look forward into the medium to longer term, China's population is projected to start falling, and the rates of industrialisation and urbanisation are expected to slow as the economy matures. And all these factors are likely to reduce the demand for steel to build urban housing and infrastructure, although the demand for steel from the manufacturing sector is expected to hold up. Policy decisions are also going to affect Chinese demand for iron ore and coking coal. So if we look at what's happened over recent years, Chinese authorities have encouraged a shift towards higher quality inputs into the steelmaking process as a way of managing pollution. There have been a number of recent policy statements in China that suggest this emphasis on managing the environmental consequences of industrialisation will continue to be a priority into the future. China also has a stated aim to increase its use of scrap over the medium term. And even though this may be somewhat of a challenge because the availability of scrap is currently limited and the availability of the recycling infrastructure is also not yet in place. After China, the two largest consumers of steel in the world are the United States and India. As an advanced economy with a very large population, the United States is likely to continue to be a large consumer of steel. But for a number of reasons, India has significantly more potential to affect the growth in demand for steel. Given current population projections, India is expected to become the most populous country in the world by 2030. India's demand for steel will also increase, or be boosted, by the fact that there's significant potential for urbanisation to increase. As people move into cities, they need somewhere to live and they need infrastructure to support their daily activities. And you can see from this graph that urbanisation rates in India are actually quite low compared with China and certainly compared with more industrialised countries like South Korea and the United States. There's also significant scope for the steel intensity of the Indian economy to increase. So what this graph shows is that steel intensity tends to increase as GDP per capita of a country increases, and that occurs up to a point where it tends to level out. You can see from this graph that China, which is the dark red line, has already reached the level where steel intensity tends to plateau. But if you look at the line for India, which is the very small line down in the bottom left-hand corner, there's quite a lot of potential for steel intensity to increase in India. The exceptions to the rule of this plateau story are Japan and South Korea, and they're exceptions effectively because they've been able to become significant exporters of steel. The Indian government has a goal to triple production of steel to around 300 million tonnes by 2030, which is an interesting date that seems to have popped up in a number of previous presentations. Most of this increase is expected to meet domestic consumption, so it's not really expected to be about developing an export market. And even if somewhat slower growth is achieved, the demand for imported coking coal from countries like Australia could increase because India's reserves of coking coal are relatively limited and they're of relatively low quality. In contrast, India is already self-sufficient in the provision of iron ore and has relatively high quality hematite reserves. Turning to gold, which is Australia's fifth largest resource by value. Elevated Australian dollar gold prices, which we heard about earlier, have resulted in a significant increase in exploration activity in Australia in recent years, and a lot of this has been concentrated in Western Australia. Gold has in fact driven the increase in national exploration expenditure since fiscal year 2016, and in 2018 accounted for 2/5 of total exploration expenditure. If we're thinking about what the prospects for gold are, around half of gold demand in 2018 was for the production of gold jewellery. And the two largest markets for gold jewellery are China and India. So based on the outlook for population growth, particularly for India, and the fact that the citizens of these countries are likely to become more wealthy over time, the longer-term demand outlook for gold would seem quite positive. So I'm going to turn now to energy-related resources. So as you might expect, energy demand is expected to increase, and the forces boosting that demand are going to be pretty similar to the forces boosting demand for construction-related resources. However, the global energy mix is expected to change significantly, and we've already heard some echoes of this in previous presentations. For Australia, the projected changes in the global energy mix are going to present both challenges and opportunities. Under an assumption that things evolve or policy evolves with, that energy demand evolves with current policies in place, BP projects that gold demand will actually be reasonably stable in its 2019 energy outlook. Given that the overall increase in energy demand, this actually implies that thermal coal's share of total energy consumption is expected to decline. At the same time, BP projects that there will be a significant increase in demand for non-fossil fuels, and this will partly be driven by the falling cost of renewable energy generation enabled by the sorts of technological change that we've been hearing about earlier today. As this transition occurs, demand for natural gas is also expected to increase. Thermal coal is one of Australia's largest energy exports. Together, Japan, China, and South Korea account for 75% of Australia's thermal coal exports. And in all three countries, there are plans to shift towards cleaner energy sources. One of those cleaner energy sources is LNG, which has become an increasingly important export for Australia. There is at least one expansionary LNG project currently under assessment in Western Australia in anticipation of further strong increases in global demand for LNG. There is also expected to be stronger demand for a range of metals that are inputs into batteries. We've heard a lot about lithium already this morning, and also a number of metals that are used intensively in renewable generation and electric vehicles. I'm sure that I don't need to tell people in this room what opportunities this offers to Australia. And in particular, in the space of lithium, there are a number of new mines that have been constructed in Western Australia in recent years, and projects are increasingly looking to value add through further downstream processing. A question then arises: how do we weigh up the challenges and the opportunities raised by the changes to the global energy mix? One way to think about that is through scenarios. By its nature, a scenario analysis is going to be based on assumptions that can be debated. But scenario analysis does provide a starting point for a conversation about what the risks are to be managed and what opportunities to prepare for. The projections for energy demand that I used earlier are from BP, and they're based on the assumption that current policies continue. BP also produces a scenario in the report about how energy demand could change where policies are broadly consistent with achieving government's commitments to climate goals set out in the Paris Agreement. Under this scenario, there is a faster transition away from carbon-emitting sources of energy, and Australia's thermal coal exports would be expected to decline. Because this transition in their energy outlook is relatively gradual, the effect on annual GDP growth would be relatively small, especially when you take into account the offsetting benefits of increased demand for LNG or inputs into the renewable energy generation are taken into account. But it is very important to recognise that the negative consequences of such a transition will be focused on specific geographic areas and communities that are unlikely to be the same as those that are reaping the benefits. And this can be particularly challenging if there are limited opportunities to find alternative employment, which is often the case in some of the coal mining areas. The question is then, what can be done to improve the ability of local communities to manage these challenges? There are also questions about what can be done to improve the ability of the economy as a whole and society more generally to manage the challenges associated with these structural changes, and perhaps more importantly, to leverage the opportunities associated with those changes. These are big questions, but they're not new questions. Australia has experienced many instances of structural change where the effects on local communities have been much greater than the effects on the economy as a whole. At the same time, a lot has been done over the past 50 years to improve the ability of the economy to adapt to structural change. For example, if we compare the recent experience of the mining investment boom with previous mining investment booms, we can see that moving to a freely floating exchange rate significantly improved the economy's ability to adjust to very large increases in export prices. The labour market is a key part of how the economy adjusts to structural change and how local communities will be affected. The ability of individuals to adapt to changes in demand for skills is another important element of this adjustment. To understand how the labour market has been changing over time, it's useful to classify jobs by whether they are routine or not, and whether they mainly use manual skills or cognitive skills. You can see from this graph that in Australia, there has been less growth in the number of routine jobs, which by their nature are relatively straightforward to automate. This process of automation requires investment in new technology, and that comes from innovation of various kinds, including research and development. Innovation and technological change are important sources of productivity growth, and that's what fundamentally underpins our economic prosperity over the longer term. Turning back to the graph, you can see that the most significant growth has been in non-routine jobs, particularly non-routine cognitive jobs. These jobs have features such as interacting with people or diagnosing and solving irregular problems that are harder to automate. This is a graph of how jobs have evolved in the economy as a whole, but you can see these forces at work in the mining industry as well. I think we've heard a couple of times now about how iron ore producers have begun to use autonomous haulage, and that replaces multiple truck drivers with a single controller. Unlike a truck driver, a controller must be highly computer literate and be able to solve a different nature of problems to what the truck driver was required to solve. But autonomous trucks also require communications technology that needs to be maintained, and this increases the demand for highly skilled communications technicians. And if we look slightly deeper into the crystal ball, changes in demand for different types of skills are likely to continue as electric mining equipment and vehicles become more commonplace and robots replace human miners, particularly in more dangerous environments. These examples suggest that mining is going to become increasingly reliant on people with IT skills of various kinds. IT security specialists will be required to ensure autonomous systems are safe from outside interference, while software engineers and data scientists will be required to optimise real-time operations. There is clearly a change in the nature of work and the skills required. It is important to emphasise, as Dr. Guthrie did before, that it does not follow that fewer people will be employed overall. This is especially true when you think about the fact that some of the demand for new skills will be met by specialised service providers in other firms and potentially in other industries. Indeed, this outsourcing of specialised services as technological progress changes the nature of work is yet another broad trend in the labour market and the way business is being done that we need to think about when we think about the future. But how are we as a country going to equip people with these skills? Or more specifically, how are firms in the mining resource sector going to do that? I think the easy way to answer that question is, say, education and training. But what does that really mean? And is that different to what we've been doing in the past? I think Dr. Guthrie has partially answered that question already, and I think we'll hear again after morning tea some more concrete examples that suggest it actually does mean we have to do things a little bit differently. The education sector will continue to have a role in making sure that future employees have work-ready skills. This is going to include teaching subject matter expertise, such as data analytics, robotics engineering, machine fitting, and the list goes on. And it also means teaching a range of more general skills, such as digital literacy, the ability to work in teams with diverse skill sets, and analytical thinking. I think it's also fair to say that the tertiary education sector will continue to play a role in providing the research that underpins technological change. And I think, as Dr. Guthrie alluded to, there are a lot of opportunities for businesses and the education to work together in this area. The retraining of current employees should also be able to meet some of the demand for new skills. Traditionally, this may have been done by on-the-job training, but increasingly firms are looking to work with the education sector to achieve this retraining. We've already heard about some examples of mining companies partnering with education providers to create courses that meet the changing employment needs, especially around automation. And this is happening much more broadly in the economy. The change in emphasis towards lifelong learning is another area where I think will open up huge opportunities. The purpose of this conference is to think about what the future holds for the resource sector. While predicting the future is difficult, understanding existing trends and running scenarios can be useful to test assumptions and highlight challenges and opportunities. The industrialisation and urbanisation of large emerging economies will continue to boost demand for commodities. Governments' commitments to significantly reduce carbon emissions are likely to benefit some parts of the resource sector, but are going to provide challenges for others. At the same time, I don't think we should forget that the economy will be constantly responding to the effects of technological change more generally. History shows that it is important to have a policy environment and institutions that allow the economy to adapt to change. A system where businesses and the education sector work together to ensure people are equipped to adapt to changing demand for skills is particularly important. There is a clear role for policy, and I think we've already heard from a couple of the earlier speakers about the sorts of policies that are already in place. And I think it's also important to focus on a change in emphasis away from you get an education and you go out and work towards one where lifelong learning improves outcomes in this space. Thank you.